Thank you. Good evening, everybody. My name is Harvey Jason, and I am a very grateful alcoholic.
Harvey.
Thank God for my sobriety today and the chance to live in a decent way. I thank God for the gift of life. I thank God for the gift of this life. And I thank God for bringing me to you and for giving you all to me and showing me what the promise of a beautiful life can be. I want to especially thank the amazing Dave Barge, wherever he may be. He's everywhere. So I don't know where he is at this particular moment, but I want to thank him for everything. He is an absolutely amazing and unbelievable man and a perfect example of Alcoholics Anonymous at its best. Thank you for the great honor of inviting me here to share with you, Dave. I also want to thank my host for his warmth and generosity. Al, it's a pleasure, and I thank you. I'm sorry you never got to show me around L.A., which I really wanted, but he refused. But thank you. Thank you anyway. I want to thank Chris and, in fact, the entire committee for their hospitality and their generosity and all the gifts. I love swag. I love T-shirts. You know, I love coffee mugs. I love it all. And thank you very much, Chris. I tell you what, I am so grateful. It used to be I was only appreciative and grateful for the big things. You know, if it was big, if it was a major importance to me, it made me happy. I realize now in retrospect, it wasn't happiness I experienced so much as self-gratification. That's what it was. Today, I find more and more it's the small things, it's the little things that give me such happiness, such joy. These clothes have never seen vomit. That's a... Yeah, they say there are no big deals. I mean, this is a big deal. I know exactly where I parked my car. I could find it at a moment's notice. I know where I spent the night. I remember everything. I was able several times in the last few days to navigate myself without help down the hall. And through my acute mathematical powers, I was able to ascertain as the numbers went up where my room would be. I am so appreciative of these things because it wasn't always like that. It really wasn't. You know, I don't know when the world stopped revolving around me, but I believe honestly it happened when I was brought by God into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the first directives or suggestions that I was given when I came in was that the guy said to me, he said, listen, Harvey, he said, forget about yourself. Absolutely forget about yourself. Put yourself on the back burner. You're so self-obsessed. All you think about is yourself. Forget it. Think about other people. And it seemed following that, it seemed that just the bat of an eye when the next person said to me, listen, I want you to come to this meeting, get on the podium, and for 45 minutes talk about yourself. And I thought, I really don't know this, what I got into here. It all seems so ironic and so what. And actually, this puts me in mind of a story which I'm going to share with you, which I particularly like, about a guy who goes to Dodger Stadium. And he walks in the stadium and it's packed. There are 45,000 people all taking their seats. And the guy looks around, he finds his seat, he starts to sit down, and suddenly he hears a booming voice, Larry, Larry, Larry. And he looks around and it's impossible to see. Starts to sit down again, he hears Larry, Larry. He gets up again and he looks, the sounds, the bleachers, nothing. Sits down again, Larry, like this goes on 3, 4, 5, 6 times. And he's getting very, very annoyed and very, very frustrated. Finally, sitting down, the 9th time, he hears Larry, like he gets up, he stretches his arms to the heavens, he says, for God's sake, my name is not Larry. this is... this is an autobiographical story. This is... story of my life. You know, I say that I am a grateful alcoholic And my gratitude is quite literally boundless. But the very first time I heard somebody get up to a podium, it was a woman, and say, "I'm a grateful alcoholic," I thought the woman was hideously deranged. I couldn't understand why anybody would be grateful to be an alcoholic. Now it's quite the opposite. If I were not an alcoholic, I would be deprived of the most rewarding life, the most rewarding spiritual life it's possible to imagine. I have been given a life through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I could never have even conceived in my wildest fantasies, dreams, hopes, or expectations. And so much of that is due, of course, to the 12 steps and working the steps as well as I can and sponsoring people and being sponsored, but so much of it is due to the warmth and the embrace of all of you. I didn't know people like you existed. I really didn't. And this weekend, this is my very first time at a roundup. It's my very first time here. And just the exuberance, you know, the wonderful embrace of everybody. Everywhere you go, from the bathrooms to the halls to the banquet halls, arms are out, hugs are waiting, you know, smiles are there. And I am such a creature of habit that it dawned on me there's an inherent danger here. There's a built-in problem. I am so reflexive that I thought, well, supposing I take it all to heart, and then the next time I'm in L.A. at home and have to go to a public men's room and put out my arms and smile at the guy at the next urinal, I'm in relatively big trouble. So I have to watch that. But I do learn from each and every one of you. I have been given such love. There are people here that I haven't known for all that long. And yet I would be hard put to imagine life without, you know, people like Andy Alcoholic and people like Rocky and people like Dave Barge and people like Jerry Summers. The courage and the bravery of these men, they exemplify the very, very best of humankind. I will tell you now in a general way what I used to be like and what happened and what I am like now. What I intend to be like, hopefully, for the rest of my days on planet Earth and beyond. I didn't come to alcohol until quite late in my life, actually, but I'll start at the beginning. I was. It's a fitting, by the way, that I'm here on the 4th of July. The 4th of July, Independence Day, strikes a chord with me, which is what it really does. I was terribly moved the opening night at the Colors, the Color Guard of the Marines, and whenever... In truth, whenever I hear the Star Spangled Banner or America the Beautiful, I get goosebumps. And Michael sang it so beautifully the other day. You see, I'm from England, and in England, on the 4th of July, they taught us that we won the war. So it's a little bit difficult, you know. But this is ironic, too. Whenever I see a glass at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always think to myself, you know, brings to mind an optimist is someone who sees the glass as half full. And the pessimist is someone who sees the glass as half empty. And the alcoholic sees the glass as completely redundant. I was born in London, England, during the Second World War. Seems like prehistoric times at this point, you know. Somebody actually said to me, I had the fortune, good fortune, share at a meeting a couple of months ago, and I said that, and afterwards somebody said, the Second World War, wow, was that after the Civil War? another illustrious example, another illustrious graduate of our superb educational system. It's amazing, isn't it? So I was born during the war, and... actually, our house in London was destroyed by a V2 rocket. And for those of you who may not know, this V2 rocket business was designed by a German scientist called Wernher von Braun. And Wernher von Braun wrote a book about his experiences, biography, autobiography, and it was called I Aim at the Stars. And I have always thought that it needed a subtitle, and I had always thought it should be called I Aim at the Stars, But Sometimes I Hit London. Anyway, our house got bombed, which is not why I became an alcoholic. I was an infant. I survived, I think. I was born to wonderful parents and grew up in an observant Jewish home, very enlightened home. I'm an only child, terribly close with my parents, a mother who adored me and whom I adored. And I know that most of us here, all of us, I dare say, know that alcoholism knows no bounds, knows no social parameters, economic lines, knows no nationality, no religions, no races, both sexes. And so it is not imperative to have had an abused or deprived or difficult or tragic childhood. And my childhood was so beautiful in every way that it was totally idyllic, really idyllic. And everything good that I learned, my mother tried to impart to me. I was a difficult student, I suppose, because I didn't absorb everything. Or I should say I absorbed it, but I didn't put things into practice. But my mother instilled in me a love of the arts and a love of poetry. And what strikes me in retrospect these days, and my mother, bless her, has been gone now for 28 years, is that so many of the expressions with which I grew up, that I learned from her, are platitudes that we know here. She said one day at a time. She loved the serenity prayer. To thine own self be true was a favorite of hers. And most of us today don't realize that that particular line from Shakespeare is followed by another line, and it runs, to thine own self be true, thou canst not then be false to any man. And I subscribe to that. I was, for most of my life, such a liar and such a cheat and such a fraud, such a true, pretentious piece of rubbish. And I was false not only to myself but to other people, and I not only lied with abandon and with relish, because I love lying. It just made, you know, I was really good at lying, you know, and I just loved it. But I believed my own lies. You know, that's another danger to all of that, to being the kind of person that I was. Anyway, I grew up, and when I was 2-3 years old, all the children in England, in London, I should say, had to be moved out of the city to the country because of the bombing, the heavy bombing raids, and so I was moved to boarding school. And in fact, it was a boarding school that heretofore had been an all-girls school. And I was, save your laughter, please. I was in the first shipment of boys to go there. There were only 4 or 5 of us. I think there were 5 boys, little boys. I was like 3 years old. And I have the 3 memories that are so vivid, and the first of these memories, and I think through my 4-step they all bear relevance on what has happened to me today. The first of these memories occurred at my very earliest recollection, and I was about 18 months old, and I was in the bathroom of our house in London, and my mother had just given me a bath, and there was a rocking chair in the bathroom. And she had me wrapped in a big, warm, fluffy towel, and I was on her lap, and her arms were around me, and I felt so protected and so loved and so cherished and so safe. And today I can feel her arms around me. I can feel the humidity and the warmth in that bathroom. It is a very, very vivid memory, and to me it is a treasured one. The second one of these 3 memories occurred when I was about, I think it was my 4th birthday, and my parents gave me a party, and all the kids came, you know, and they're all little boys in short trousers, all well-behaved little bastards, really, but they all came, you know, and they all shook hands, and little girls, little curtsies, you know. This was another age, ladies and gentlemen. And he gave me presents. And I felt I was the star of the show. You know, I really felt very, very important. And the third of these memories occurred at this boarding school. And since I was one of these 5 little boys, and I was no more than 5 years old, younger, really, And they're all bunk beds, dormitory style, you know, and all the girls. And during the night, all the girls would take me out of my bed and they'd pass me from girl to girl and they'd cuddle me and touch me. And this is a fantasy I've been chasing for years. In truth. But these three memories, you see, mean to me that there was a sense that I was entitled to be loved. I had a sense of entitlement, and love was crucial to me. So when I grew older and got into my teens and realized, you know, that I wasn't handsome and I wasn't tall and I wasn't athletic, in spite of the fact I had a good deal of hair at that point, didn't mean anything. But I wasn't all of these things, and I needed that love. I wanted that love. I would thrive on that love. So I had to devise for myself, and again, all of this is a retrospective analysis, of course, but I had to do something, be someone, to get you all to love me. I didn't care about being admired. I didn't care about being respected. I wanted adoration. And so what that compelled me to do was to be a different person with each of you. So I had, successfully, I had no true identity of my own. I'd be with somebody and I knew what, instinctively, what I was supposed to be with them, and I'd do that. I'd be serious with one person. I'd be funny with another person. And after a while, after many, many years of this, it occurred to me one day, I didn't know who I was. I was a chameleon, which is the nice way of saying that I was an abject fraud. And that's not a nice place to be. At age 19, my mother had encouraged my independence, and I left home at 17. So I was in New York at age 19. Now, at this point, and I was pursuing a career which had already been defined for me, predicated on the fact that I needed to be adored by lots and lots of strangers. It doesn't make a lot of sense. That is the way I am. That is the way I was. So I'm in New York. I'm living with a woman who's a few years older than I am. And this, to me, is how alcoholism works. I had not yet begun my misadventures with booze. Didn't happen, actually, really late. I mean, I didn't start drinking alcoholically until I was in my 20s. But I was an alcoholic. And I suffered from advanced alcoholism. And when I was in New York, it occurred to me in a moment of terrific clarity. This was at the time when Fidel Castro in Cuba was leaving Oriente Province and he was going to take over the country. And I knew with assurance, absolute certainty, that he needed my help. This is not a joke, this is not a fantasy. I was convinced that Fidel Castro needed me. He needed Harvey Jason to make this political adventure work. Now, I decided, and I said to my girlfriend, we've got to get down, we'll hitchhike, we have no money, we'll get down to Key West, and we will take a banana boat, and we will get to Cuba. And then we will go up into the hills of Oriente Province, where they'll be waiting for me, and I will get on my horse. I didn't know how to ride or anything. I will get on my horse, and Fidel Castro, his brother Raul, Che Guevara, and Harvey Jason will ride down through the streets of Havana, and people will throw garlands of flowers, and we'll take over the country. Now, in truth, I know nothing about Cuban history. I don't speak Spanish. I don't really like Cuban food. But I was absolutely convinced that this was crucial for me to do. Crucial. And we hitchhiked down to Florida. And by the time we got down there to Key West, all the banana boats, all the boats had closed. We were not allowed to get there. So we're stuck in Key West, Florida. No food, no money. I did the only sensible thing. I helped my girlfriend look for a job. I got her a job, and then we stayed there for a while, and I wasn't comfortable, and I thought my political career was in shambles. There was nothing about me in the papers. It was a catastrophe as far as I was concerned. And ultimately, we hitchhiked back to New York. Shortly thereafter, I got married. Another misadventure. And I've since stopped believing. I don't believe any longer in love at first sight. To me, you know what? I think love at first sight is simply a side effect of serious drinking. I really believe this. Anyway, I got married to this lady, and she really had... it was a terrible thing for her to have married me. She was very beautiful, and she was also English, and she was very sexy, and she was very socially well-connected, very wealthy, and as far as I was concerned, at that time, she didn't have a brain in her head. As a matter of fact, she was an extremely brilliant woman. It was me that didn't have a brain in my head. The last time, it was a quick marriage. It was a couple of years, and that was it. As a matter of fact, the last image she had of me, the very last time she ever laid eyes on me, was when I was in a drunken collapse between the cases, the luggage place at JFK in New York. And in fact, I can still see her looking down at me with a look of intense disgust. And that was a look with which I have become intimately familiar over the years. But I remember that. I'll tell you something else. She was a terrifying woman, because before I met her, when I first met her, I thought she was really tough, you know, really steel, very proper English word, you know. It wasn't until we got to know each other and so forth, I realized she was very sensitive and she was very innocent, and that was just a protection. She was insecure. Well, when I was going to make amends, this was the one that I really was terrified to do, and I did not know where she was. She had been involved as a ballet teacher in one of the big ballet companies in Europe, and I didn't know where she was, and I tried to locate her and couldn't do so. Excuse me. My younger son, who is much more proficient at the computer than I am, got on the computer, and through a couple of lengthy processes, he was able to track her down, which was not really what I wanted, because I was, I was really scared. And so I got by myself, I collected what few thoughts remained in my head, and I dialed the number. And my heart was pounding, and there was no answer. So I was off the hook. So I waited a bit, and then I dialed again sometime later, and the phone was picked up. And there was this voice, stern and ice cold, but exactly the same as I remembered, but older. And she picked up the phone, and I hear, "Hello?" And it took me a second, and I said, "Helen?" She said, "Yes, who is this?" And I said, "Helen, gee, it's nice to hear your voice." She said, "Who is this?" I said, "That's a funny thing. It's been a very long time." I said, "This is really a voice from the past. You don't really sort of have any idea who this is? It's been years, you know." And then she got angry. She said, "Look, who is this? Tell me who it is, or I'm putting the phone down." I said, "Well, actually, it's Harvey." And there was a very long pause. And she said three words. "How utterly bizarre." So I said, I tell you why I'm calling you. I said, I'm at the point in my life where I'm really trying to clean up some dreadful behavior of mine. And, I said, I wonder what I can do. I said, I gave you such a dreadful time, such a horrific time. I was just so awful. I was a wretched, dreadful husband. And I really... She said, no, you weren't. I said, no, I was. I was a dreadful, faithless husband. And there was another long pause. And she said, "What do you mean, faithless?" But you know what? She had such generosity of spirit that she saved me. Because I thought, honestly, I can't hurt her. And she said, no, she said, never mind. She said, we were both very young and passionate and so forth. And I thought, what a wonderful response. What a truly generous reaction to somebody who wants to make amends. I have since, by the way, remarried and have been married for a very long time, not long enough. Last November the 29th, it was 35 years. And my darling Pamela, my love with all my heart, has given me two gorgeous sons, now adults, 30 and 34, and she stayed with me all of this time. And she's a devoted member of Al-Anon, which I love. You can only imagine what I've put up with all these years. In fact, I went to my very first Al-Anon meeting today and got a great deal out of it, really a great deal out of it. And I went to the Al-Anon luncheon, and I'm most appreciative. I think that Al-Anon is a life-saving program. It's an absolutely another miraculous way of life. And I know for sure that that my life would be totally different if my wife hadn't gone to Al-Anon with my sons. In fact, I knew nothing about Al-Anon. And my wife, many years ago, took my two sons to Al-Anon. I didn't know what it was. And I was out there, and then one day I found out what it was, and I came home and I said to her, you know what? I said, oh, you are really gullible. I said, I'll tell you something. I have just found out where you've been going with the boys and what Al-Anon is. You don't even know this. I said, Al-Anon is a program for people who have an alcoholic in their family. I said, you know, we don't have any alcoholics in our family. But I sincerely believed this. Well, I say I did. I didn't really. I have to tell the truth, or otherwise my wife will hop up and yell, he's lying, he's lying. You know? But I love it. I love what Al-Anon has done. Selfishly, what Al-Anon has done for me and the growth that I have seen in my sons and certainly in Pamela. It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. We have a marriage which is blissful, blissful. And it's all predicated on the fact that both of us practice the steps, that both of us practice this way of life, this gloriously fulfilling way of life with each other and in all of our affairs. So, here's what happened. I drank once in a while, and I had no real reason to drink at that point because everything seemed to be going my way. I had an opportunity to come out to California to do some work, to do a job. And I should preface this by saying that in spite of these outward manifestations of bravado and self-confidence that I managed to show through the years, inside me, I was riddled with fear. I have always had that terrible, terrible combination for me of insecurity, feelings of inferiority, and grandiosity. So the worse I feel about myself, the more bravado will I exhibit. The most fearful I am about making any decisions, the more outwardly confident I appear to be. In fact, I realize that because I was for so many, many, many years so riddled with feelings of inferiority and so penetrated so very deeply with fear that I perceived everything differently. I was totally irrational. Now, if I perceive things differently, if a waiter brings me coffee and it's not quite hot enough, I wonder why he hates me. So it's all about me. It's all about me and what I perceive. And I have come to realize that because I perceive things which are not real, my responses are going to be predicated on these false beliefs. And because my responses are going to be so irrational, the results of my actions will be awful. Will be awful. But what do I expect? I'm a living lie. I'm walking around living a lie. So I get called out to California to come and do a job. And I'm invited to a dinner party, a very important dinner party, which I thought was a dinner party. I was too naive to realize that these things are really, invariably, they are business affairs. So I go out there, and there's a lot of important people at this dinner party, and my host, I love telling jokes. I know thousands of jokes. I love telling jokes. And my host knew this, and I suppose, in a way, I was invited there also as sort of the free entertainment. So I'm sitting there, and I'm totally intimidated. I feel this high, I'm frightened, I want to crawl under the table and I want to run home, back to my hotel. And he's looking at me, you know. And I am struck, literally mute. Mute. I was so fearful, I could not make a sound. And I tried, and nothing would come out of my mouth. I was frightened. I wanted to run out of that door, and I wanted to destroy myself. Before I had come to California, some friends of my parents owned a company called Bowler Wine. And the guy said to me, when you get out to California, he said, just give me your address, wherever the hotel, I'll send you a couple of cases of wine. I said, oh, thank you. I went back to my hotel, and the wine was there. And I thought, my God, I'm just nothing. I'm just so... I felt... Awful doesn't say it, but I'm sure that you people with your sensitivity know exactly how I felt and what I mean. I went back and I opened up a bottle of wine, and I guzzled that bottle of wine down. And when I had that first bottle of wine, I thought, you know what, really and truly, it was only one evening, you know, it wasn't that bad. And then I opened a second bottle of wine, and I guzzled that bottle down faster than the first bottle. And then I thought to myself, you know what? These people were lucky that I went there in the first place. No. But you see, then I had my elixir. Then I knew exactly what to do. Because for me, at that point, at that time, that was the truth. That really was the truth. So I thought, okay, well, this is quite cool. Now, this was not a conscious decision on my part. But I knew instinctively, and what followed... was instinctively, when I was in a position of difficulty, out came, it wasn't wine, it was vodka, out came the vodka bottle, out came the bottles, out came the gallons and the half gallons and so forth. And I had my life's medicine. And I didn't drink every day, in fact, maybe every other day, but I didn't drink every day. I'm not a common drunk, you understand. I'm worse. But what I did was I drank for 3 decades, 30 years, and I drank that booze until the booze drank me. And while I have heard a couple of magnificent speakers here over the last couple of days, like Karen and Ralph, who have had some really, really tragic occurrences, my losses were not their losses. And while I didn't lose material things, I still had my house, I still had my wife and my children, still had my work, but I lost the one thing which is so very, very crucial and so very, very precious and so very, very vulnerable and easy to lose. I lost all self-respect. And I lost my soul. I lost my soul. And so my perception of my world was a dark one. It was dark, and it was pessimistic, and it was morose. And while on the outside, work was fine, there were times when it wasn't quite so fine, so I drank more during those times. But I have a study in the back of my house, and I would go home and I would lock myself in the study where I'd hidden all my booze, and I would drink myself into oblivion, and then I'd manage to come out for dinner. When the boys were growing up, Pamela and the boys would sit at the table, and they never knew who was going to come out of that room. And to this day, I can see the look of total disappointment in Pamela's eyes. And I can look back, and with great vivid recollection, I can see the look of bewilderment in the eyes of my sons and the look of fear. And I was never at any time physically abusive, but it's the mouth. It's the mouth. My mother used to say, words are like birds. They fly away, and you can't take back what you said. Today, I would give anything to take back some of the things that my sons have heard me say. I can't do that, of course. So what I can do is what you've taught me to do, to live a living amends, to be the best person I can. I have done things that to me are absolutely disgusting and reprehensible beyond words. I remain an observant Jew, and my Judaism is precious to me. And for me, the essence of Judaism is the same. It's the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the same four words. Do the right thing. Do the right thing. And at one point, I was in synagogue, and I was leading the service in Hebrew, and I was reeking of alcohol. And I stood there when this awareness hit me with a solid thought that here I am in the house of God and I'm drunk. And I left and I felt so wretched. I felt lower than dirt. I felt so appalling until the next morning, and it didn't stop me. And I kept going and going and going. And you know, when one lives with someone else and one drinks, what I would do, I would have a Bible in the study, and I've always been a book collector, and I have lots of floor to ceiling bookcases and all the books. So I used to hide my bottles, you know, behind the books, and I would come in on a daily basis, and Pamela will have pulled out books all over the place looking for bottles, you know. And so what I would do, and I didn't know how to get rid of the empties, you know, I would gift wrap them, you know. I had so many bottles. I would buy gift wrap paper and brown butcher's paper. I'd throw gifts of empty bottles of vodka on neighbors' lawns, you know. There were so many, many, many times when I had big packages, you know, and I'd go to the post office and I would take these big packages, and every time I would try to open the thing and push the packages in, it seemed at each opportunity people were watching me, like I was a terrorist sending bombs into the thing, you know. But I used to go to three different liquor shops, because God forbid I'd go to the same one and people would think I might have had some sort of a drinking problem. So I went to one. I always carried a shoulder bag, and in the shoulder bag, I would come home with two bottles of Heineken. I don't like beer, really, but I had two bottles of Heineken. But in the bag would be, like, you know, a quarter vodka, a fifth of vodka. So I went. One of the places was a Thai place. A Thai family owned it. And as one walked in, behind the counter were all the liquor bottles, and to the right were the freezers with the beer and so forth. And I would go in. I would get my two bottles of Heineken's out of there, because I'd say to Pamela, this is all I'm having. I'd take the two bottles of beer. I'd put them on the counter. And then the woman, the Thai woman, would come and she'd say, that's it? I'd say, no, wait a minute, what did she want? And I did this all the time. And then I'd say, what is that? Is that the clear one? That's that one, the big one there. Yeah. And then I would take that bottle, I'd put it in my shoulder bag. Then I'd come home with two bottles of beer. And I'd say to Pamela, no, this is it. No joke, I promise you, just two bottles of beer. And then I would go into the study, and I'd finish, like, you know, half a quart before dinner, and then I'd have the beer, so the smell of the beer would stay on my breath, and then I'd come out. Invariably, Pamela would say to me, look at you, two beers? I mean, you can hardly stand. And I would say, in all innocence, you know what, I have no tolerance. That's just the way it is. I can't take it anymore. You know, and then I would go to these other two places, the Sunbeam Market and one three doors down, and they were run by an Iranian family, and I'd go to one like on a Monday, go to the Thai place on Tuesday, go to the other Iranian place on Wednesday. Well, I did the Iranian thing one day, and then 2 days later I went back to the other Iranian place, and it seemed to me it was the same Iranian guy from the place 2 days before. It took me the longest time to realize it was a family business. You know, it was the same people in both. But what ultimately happened was in the bathroom of the study at home, which used to be a maid's room and bath, I no longer needed the bathtub. So I had a cabinet maker come over and get a beautiful piece of work, and he put oak over it and he enclosed the tub in this great oak case. One day I'm in the bathroom and I'm thinking to myself, you know, if I could pry up the top of this bathtub, I would have a perfect place for the empties. So I waited until Pamela and the boys were out of the house, and then I got out my toolbox, and it took me virtually an hour and a half, as I recall, and I finally got this huge oak slab up, and I had a virgin bathtub, you know. And I thought, this is absolutely fantastic. I mean, I felt I deserved the Pulitzer Prize. I really did. Well, from then on, Pamela was mystified. You know, the books would all be in disarray, and I'd come in, and she'd come into the study, and always the same thing. What is this? And I'd say, what? What? And she couldn't figure it out. Well, one day I was coming home, and I put the key in the front door, excuse me, to open the lock, and the door opened by itself. And standing there was Pamela and my father, both of them looking very serious. And both of our sons have medical problems. And I thought something had happened to one of the boys. I said, what's the matter? And they both didn't say it, just said, come here. And I had no idea. I go through the house. As we get to the back, I thought, oh, no. Oh, this couldn't possibly be. And sure enough, we go into the study and into the bathroom. The top of this tub is up, and in this bathtub are dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of bottles, quarts and gallons and half gallons and miniatures and pints and fifths and half, dozens, almost to the top, bottles and bottles and bottles. And my father very quietly said, what's this? I mean, what does one say? So I said, you know, why would the neighbors come over and do something like this to me? You know. I mean, a really shocking, shocking thing. But you know what? Nothing stopped me. And I kept drinking and drinking, and the world looked really glum to me. And I cannot tell you why I drank, other than I was so despondent. I was so miserable. I felt useless. And the more I drank, the more useless I, in fact, was. I just was morbidly, morbidly depressed. I never wanted to get out of bed. I would wake up in the morning. You know that feeling. A lot of you know that feeling. My mouth tasting of the carpet and my head throbbing, my hands shaking. The shakes, the shakes, the shakes. And I wanted to pull, and did, pull the sheets over my head and just stay in bed because everything was bleak. And it never dawned on me that I'm the one who had made it so bleak. And although I believed in God, I bargained with God. I chose to use God when God would benefit or could benefit me. I never really, really spiritually connected with God. It was, I'll do this for you. If you give me this, oh, I'll be really good. I mean, I'll do this. Sometimes I didn't even verbalize it, and sometimes I did. I had a Bible in the study, and sometimes I would go in there, and I'd put my hand on that Bible, and I'd say, Dear God, I swear I will not drink today. And I didn't drink that day. And the next day, I'd go into the study, I'd walk to the Bible, and I'd say, you know what? I'm not going to drink today. I don't have to do this. And I didn't, and of course, I would drink. And I drank, and I drank, and it seemed like It was just a living hell. And the occupation which I had enabled me to be fortunate enough to really go all over the world. And I could see places and have adventures that I could never see or go to before. But no matter where it was, you know, whether it was Australia, whether it was Thailand, wherever it was, the first thing that dawned on me was nothing to do with the place, but, oh, wow, now I can go and I can drink without Pamela looking over my shoulder. When I wasn't drinking, I was obsessed with drinking, obsessed with it. And I had an opportunity to work with, to work with the most famous film director in the world. I'm not saying this in any way to brag. And it was a great opportunity for me. And although I was excited about it, it was secondary to the fact that I could go there and I could drink. I didn't want him to see me drinking, but the booze affected my work performance, unquestionably. And the director happened to be what I now know is called an enabler. And so he would say, you know, it's so good that you can feel so comfortable, and you know. But even then, it was king to me. It was emperor to me. The booze was everything to me. It was all I thought about. I didn't have any health problems other than shaking and feeling terrible all the time. And I would wake up, you know, I mean, you know, whether it was the drunk tank or whether it was going through the humiliations of getting in those positions for the cops, the station house or jail, or whether I'd wake up in the... I spent many, many nights on the ground or in the garage or behind the wheel. I'd drive home drunk and I'd park. I wouldn't put the top down and I'd wake up in the morning or come to in the morning. Pamela would invariably be standing there looking at me. And I'd be slumped over the steering wheel and I'd get the window down and I'd say, you know what? I was so tired. You know, it seemed such an effort to come into the house. I was so comfortable, you know, really here, you know. Give me that Al-Anon smile and just walk away. I used to sleep with a notebook under my bed in case I had ideas, you know, the script. I was such a master, you know, an artistic maestro. About as much talent as this glass. And I couldn't read my writing. In the morning would come, I'd have great ideas, you know, but in the morning I couldn't read what I had written. And so what I did was I got a little tape recorder. So one night, I'm dead drunk, and in the middle of the night, I wake up, and I have an absolutely brilliant idea. A work of genius. And so as not to disturb Pamela, I take the little tape recorder into the bathroom, and I begin to record it. Now, this was a Western. I don't like Westerns, but this was a Western. And this script came out fully formed in my head. The structure, the characters, the tension of the piece, it was brilliant. And I went into that bathroom. I don't know how long I was in there for. It had to be an hour or 45 minutes. And I dictated the entire script into the tape recorder. When I went to bed, I knew that if I didn't get an Oscar nomination for the script... at least I was sure to get a Writers Guild nomination, if not win. I knew it. So in the morning, I come to, Pamela's not in bed, and I'm shaking, and my head's throbbing, and I'm sweating, and that putrid smell is coming out of every pore. And I remember that I had written this. I don't remember anything at all about the script, but I knew I'd written a winner. I go under the bed. I see the tape recorder. It's all the way at the end. I press the rewind. It goes all the way back to the front. Now I'm ready. I press play. And I hear... I press stop. I press play. This can't be. They've taken my trophy away. And they... I played it all the way through to the end and did not understand one syllable and had no idea what this was all about. Today, I have a slight suspicion that it may be The Unforgiven and Clint Eastwood stole it from me. One night, I had a particularly dreadful drunk. I mean, a really appalling drunk. Maybe no worse than others, but maybe it was just my time. And I woke up in the morning, and I was collapsed on the floor of the study. And for whatever reason, I thought, this has got to stop. I've had it. I've had my run. It's finished. It's finished. And I called my closest friend in the world. It's like my brother. He was actually also my agent, and he was a very devoted member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe some of you know him. May he rest in peace. His name was Robert Lippman. And Bobby Lippman saved hundreds, literally hundreds of people from alcoholism, and he couldn't save himself. He couldn't stay sober. In the end, Bobby died sober. Bless him. But I called Bobby and I said, you know, I had written another script that sold, and they were paying me to write a polish the script. So I called Bobby and I said, listen, Bobby, I said, since the studio, since these producers are paying me to do a polish on this script, the protagonist of the piece is a recovering alcoholic. I never put two and two together. I just wrote about a recovering alcoholic. I said, since they're paying me for a polish, probably what I should do is go to one of your meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous just to get an idea of the layout of the room and so forth. And I believed this. I believed it. I mean, I wasn't saying, I believed this. I met Bobby. This was a Friday night, Saturday morning. I met Bobby on Sunday morning on the corner of Pico and Robertson in Los Angeles. And he was going to take me to a meeting of the Robertson Originals. And we met on the corner, and he hugged me, and he said, Harvey, Harvey, he was an Englishman. He said, you don't know how lucky you are not to be an alcoholic like me. And I said, oh, I bet. No, I know. I can imagine. And he took me into this long hall. I saw podium set up, and I saw rows of chairs with keys and things on the chairs. And I sat down in the seat, and a woman got up at the podium, and she shared her experience, strength, and hope. And while this woman's experiences were not similar, were not exactly the same as mine, the emotions that she felt and which she so lucidly expressed were identical, identical to mine. And before I knew what was happening, the tears were streaming down my cheeks. And I knew I was home. I was home. And from that day to this, I was determined to plunge soul first into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got a sponsor, and I got a home group, I got a big book, and I immersed myself in all the literature. I began on the steps immediately, and I absorbed everything. Me, with a brain that was not so hot, was able to absorb and to assimilate what needed to be absorbed and assimilated. And my friends, my life changed absolutely. Absolutely. First year, I went to meetings all the time. I went to a Tuesday night, which is a mixed meeting, not a stag, a mixed meeting at Roxbury. I didn't know anybody. And I was outside at the front doors, and I could hear in one of the other rooms of this park building, there was a tap dancing class. And I was out there feeling sorry for myself, standing there and hearing the tap, tap, tap of the tap dancers. And a car came into the parking lot, and I thought I recognized the woman behind the wheel. And when she got out, it was a woman named Demetra, whom I have known for many, many years from another life. Another business. And I'm listening to these tap dancers, and I see Demetra, and I think, my God, of all the people in the world, the least likely person to take tap dancing lessons. And it was Demetra who came to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I then began to go regularly every Wednesday to the men's stag at Roxbury, and I didn't like it. I felt very insecure. Everybody seemed to know each other, and I felt very isolated, and I felt very out of it. And I felt it was a big clique, and I didn't belong there. But I went, you know, and then I stopped going, and then I went and took a cake. And then one night when I was there, I heard something. And I heard a succession of somethings. And I thought, my God, in the few weeks since I'd stopped coming, how all these men have changed. And now, I tell you in truth, I live for Wednesday night Roxbury. These men are my lifeblood. They are my heart. I learn from the example of these men, it's not what they say, but when I'm caught up in their embrace, their physical embrace, as well as their psychological and their spiritual embrace, the example of these men can in no way ever, ever, ever be bettered. It is an infusion of spirituality, and I ingest inspiration every moment I am in that room. I have seen and continue to see men face obstacles before which many of us would collapse with fright. And they persevere, and there's a smile on their face, and there are smiles in their heart, and they only care about helping someone else. They only care about helping someone else. Their mission in life is to be of service to other people, to share what they have with other people. And it's never do this or do this. It's listen to what I, here's what I did. Here's what I did. I adore these men. I adore them. They're my mentors. They're my friends. They're my idols. They're my heroes. And I have learned the beauty of life. I have a life beyond anything I could have imagined. I wake up in the morning with joy. It's beyond happiness. It's beyond it. I am in a state of ecstasy. I have nothing but rampant enthusiasm for this life, all based upon this life-saving program, this program that affords us an existence that would have been impossible to imagine. And if you're new here tonight, I can well assure you, you have no idea what can be in store for you. You have no idea. I beg of you to be willing, just to be willing to take the action. I didn't have hope. I'm not big on acronyms, but one night I was in bed and I suddenly was visualizing the word hope and I saw H-O-P-E, hold only positive energy. I thought, you know what? That makes sense to me. And I know, you see, I get up in the morning, I say my prayers with relish. I talk to God. I ask him for help. I say some of the prayers in Hebrew and some in English because I believe God is at least bilingual. I ask for help. I believe with all my heart because I have been shown the truth. I have been shown what life can be. I know that when I talk to God, that's called prayer. I hear God talk back to me, that's called schizophrenia. And at night, I talk to God throughout the day. You know, it had been a pipe dream of mine for a long, long time. I thought, you know, some of us have pipe dreams. Even when I was drinking, I thought, what a wonderful thing it would be to open a really wonderful first editions bookshop, you know, selling signed Hemingway and Faulkner and Steinbeck. Another gift of sobriety is that 1 year into this program, my younger son and I opened that shop. We opened that shop, the shop that was a pipe dream. And from the outset, and this is not false modesty, very little credit to Louis and I, that shop became instantly successful. And I think I know why. It's because Louis being in Al-Anon and me being a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous were able to put into effect the precepts and the concepts and the principles of this program. To treat people honestly, the way we want to be treated, to be hospitable, to be kind, to be of service. This would never have worked, this endeavor, if I was still out there. I would have robbed these people blind. I would have robbed them blind without a second thought. I would have sold them inferior merchandise. Today, if there is our books are in great condition, but the slightest flaw, I point out to people. Not because I'm a good guy, but because you have taught me. Because if I do anything dishonest or unethical or immoral, is that how I'm going to repay God for giving me this life? It's the same thing for me. I can't imagine picking up another drink. Because you see, what I didn't realize when I was out there is that every time I picked up a bottle, every single time, I was spitting in the face of God. I was saying to God, I don't want what you've given me. I want more. I want more. Give me more. This isn't good enough. And I can't do that. I won't do that. I don't want to do that. My life depends on my sobriety. I have it too good. I have it way, way, way too good. I haven't received justice. I have received a high abundance of mercy. That's what I've received. And how can I pay God back for all of these rewards, for all of the goodness that I feel in here? Not the material things, but giving me, most importantly, the one commodity that I assumed, that I thought was absolutely unattainable to me. Peace of mind. Peace of mind. I was always an insomniac. I couldn't sleep. I'd pass out. I sleep like a baby today. I sleep like a baby. I have peace of mind. I've been afforded complete serenity. And it is a glorious, glorious life. And how can I pay God back for these gifts? Only by being the best Harvey that Harvey can be. Simple life. It's simple, you know. What possible reward is better for me today than to look at Pamela and see her look at me with love and with pride? And see my sons look at me with great smiles and call me constantly and want to go on holiday with me and spend time with me. Our little family of four is so close, we are inseparable. I owe it all to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe it all to people like you in rooms like this. I owe it all to the steps of this program. I owe it all to the glory of God who in his wisdom and mercy got me into these rooms. This is something I never, ever would have done by myself. I know there's not a shred of doubt in my mind that God brought me into these rooms. And my purpose is to stay sober and to help another alcoholic. I have such immense joy in working with people like Paul, and Lefty, and Stuart, and Bruce, noble men, men who have come here to support me tonight, men who share the same joy I do going through these steps, men who have given me the immense privilege of allowing me into their lives in the most intimate of ways, and who have endowed me with their trust, because they know that I won't let them down. Now, I intend to give them each a few dollars from every CD I sell of their fourth step. What a joy to show people what I've been given, to share it all. Is there a greater joy? I don't think so. I can only say that today, here walks the happiest of men, the very, very happiest of men. I have finally become, through the grace of God, the man that I know my mother wanted me to become. The man that would make my father proud. My father did get to see me sober, And I don't think he could believe it, actually, because quite often he'd say to me, "You mean you haven't had one drink?" Now, in terms of the tenure of sobriety in this room, I have very little sobriety. I have 3,291 days, thank God. By the grace of God, today, last Wednesday, I celebrated 9 years of sobriety. I clap for you, because you've given it to me. You know, they say that miracles only occur to people who believe in miracles. I'm not so sure that's true, but I do know that each and every one of us here are the recipients of that miracle. There's a story that I like, and then I'll sit down. I think my time is up. There is a story of a guy who goes duck hunting, and he goes there, and he got his dog with him, and he shoots the duck, and the duck falls into the water, and the dog trots over to the water's edge, and then the dog gets on top of the water and walks on the water, picks up the duck in his mouth, walks on the water back, and drops the duck. Well, the guy is bewildered. He can't believe it. He shoots another duck. The same thing happens. So he says to the guy next to him, "Listen, you've got to watch this. Just watch this. Watch this." Shoots the duck, another duck. The dog goes right on top of the water again, walks on the water, comes back on the water, drops the duck. The man says, did you see what just happened? And the friend looks, he says, "You know what? I think I did. Your dog can't swim." Some of us see the miracle, some of us don't. It really is impossible for me to thank all of you, but please be assured that you have my love and my thanks and will have that eternally. God bless us all. Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful. 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 Very good. Good.